This is Canadian Wealth Wisdom by Trilogue to Private Wealth, and in this series, we focus on the financial facelift segment of the Globe and Mail. My name is Kyle Taylor, and I am pleased to be joined by a regular contributor to the financial facelift column, Matthew Ardrey, portfolio manager and senior financial planner with Trilogue to Private Wealth. Matthew joined TriDelta in 2016, but has been in the wealth management industry for over 20 years. He holds several industry designations, including the Certified Financial Planner, Registered Financial Planner, Chartered Investment Manager, and Financial Management Advisor. Welcome, Matt.
Thanks, Scott.
So as part of this series, we are going to be looking at real-life examples, which Matt completed financial planning with individuals and couples who were then featured in the Globe and Mail Financial Facelift column. I will look to set the stage with who today's couple features and the situation they find themselves in. Matt will then have the opportunity to discuss the plan, options considered, and ultimately what the path forward resulted in. So let's meet David and Greta. David is turning 57 this year and eager to retire. He currently earns $250,000 a year and is entitled to a defined benefit pension of $63,755 a year once retired. His wife, Greta, is 55 and already retired. They have an adult son and are debt-free with a net worth of $1.7 million. This couple had two main questions for you. One, how to establish a steady retirement paycheck to supplement David's pension income, and when to take CPP OAS, which is a common one that we often get. Now, that's a very high-level description of this couple. What else can you tell me about David and Greta?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, David and Greta are sort of in their mid to late 50s, looking to be sort of fully retired out of the workforce this year, spending $95,000 a year. Inflation that we use inside the projection, I used a base rate of 3% and life expectancy of 95. Now, I realize these are higher than the Bank of Canada's 2% target and longer than what StatsCan has the average person living. However, this helps keep the plan conservative yet reasonable. Now, David is lucky with his pension because it is indexed to inflation. So that gives him a huge advantage in covering his expenses going forward. However, his pension's topped out at 2% of inflation. So that means if he has a year with 6% inflation, that happens in life, he only gets 2% of that, or about one third. So that certainly still can erode the purchasing power of his income stream. There's also a bridge benefit to 65, which means that he's actually going to get a top up that's basically going to make up for CPP and OAS in between 57 and 65, and it falls off then. They did have a whole bunch of cash on the sidelines. So I did ask them about that. They were planning at least $100,000 worth of home renovations, and the cash would be largely used for that. And of course, you know, as any homeowner is familiar with who's done a renovation, whatever you think it's going to cost, it'll cost more. From government pension perspective, David looks like he's going to get, you know, max CPP or something really close to it, and old age security. Greta didn't do a lot of work in her life. They estimate about 20% CPP for her. And they asked about, you know, what should we do in terms of CPP and OAS, and certainly crunching some numbers in the plan, which we'll get into a little bit more later. It was better for them to delay till 70 instead of taking it at 65, so we proceeded with that assumption. Outside the cash and GICs they had for the renovation, the rest of the portfolio was largely in stocks and balanced funds. When we break out the balanced funds to their underlying asset classes, they were sitting about 84% in stocks. This, of course, when you're entering retirement, adds some volatility risk to their portfolio. And they also had about 45% of their investment in A-class mutual funds, which, of course, is the class of mutual funds with the higher MERs when compared to an F class. These are supposed to be for fees and advice purposes. I don't feel they were getting any advice as they were coming along, because otherwise why would they be coming to the Globe and Mail for a financial facelift? But certainly, you know, given the amount of their net worth, these can be definitely invested in a different way, which I discussed as part of my analysis. And finally, they did ask us about annuities. You know, should they annuitize their assets? And my response was, they already have, because he has a pension. A pension is essentially an annuity. So there's really not a need to have further annuities. In fact, I would rather have the investments available just in case there's a need for a larger liquidation for an expense or anything like that.
With one of their key goals being creating a steady retirement income, how is the portfolio invested today, and what can you tell me about them as investors?
So I asked them about the A-class mutual funds, and we've had some conversations around about it. When they started out, they didn't know anything about investing, so the local guy in their hometown, there wasn't a lot of options. This is what he had, and so that's what they did. As they became more knowledgeable, they switched over to do it themselves, investors, with David doing most of the research and everything else. So the remainder of the portfolio is largely invested in large cap dividend paying stocks, which I'll say is not the worst thing you can do as an investor. The problem is now is where they are in their life. They're no longer accumulating assets. They're going to be switching from decumulating. How do you create that regular income stream, as David and Greta were asking? So now there's a lot more risk factors in there. First being sequence of returns. If all of a sudden they retire and the markets, instead of going up 20-25% as they did last year, what if they plummet 20-25%? What if that's 35? What if it's 40 because there's some major global crisis? And now they're going to be drawing money from a portfolio that's 84% stocks. There's nowhere to run. There's nowhere to hide. You are crystallizing losses and creating permanent losses that is going to be a detriment to your long-term retirement. So they need to look at what their overall asset mix is and make tweaks to that asset mix to improve that and protect themselves from that type of risk.
I think that sequence of return risk is certainly an underappreciated one, and it's an important one that you bring up. I did want to ask about the A-class mutual funds that you mentioned in this response and the one before that. Were they surprised to learn that there were other classes of funds out there? And maybe for people who aren't familiar, you can go into what the different classes mean?
Yeah, I don't think they were particularly surprised. I think they, by the time I got to them, they knew and they understood. They were just, I guess, in inertia with these particular investments. They were like, well, they're here and we're not adding to it anymore. But, we don't know what else we're going to do with it. We're just going to leave it. So certainly the idea of the A-class mutual fund is it pays a trailer to the advisor. So the advisor gets paid a certain amount out of the management expense ratio paid by the client to provide financial services and advice. So, hey, everyone's got to eat, everyone's got to get paid. My typical problem with these types of funds is different funds pay different trailers, different commissions. So there may be a potential for bias in terms of recommending fund A over fund Z, in terms of one may pay the advisor more than the other. Maybe that second fund is actually better for the client, maybe it's not. Comparatively, we have the F-class fund. This is what you would use if you were not giving advice or if you're charging separately for advice. So if you had a fee-only planner who charged you $2,000 a year for your advice or whatever they charge, and they were recommending funds, this is what they would recommend because they're getting paid separately for the advice. And also for us here at TriDelta, if we are adding any external funds, that is what we're doing as well, because we do not accept any commissions, trailers, anything like that, which allows us to be unbiased in our recommendations to clients.
And the actual management fee is a big difference too as well, right? The A-class can be 2% plus, and the F-class, which is effectively the same funds, can be 0.8% to around 1%. So it certainly matters in the long-term scheme of things when you're looking at returns and how that impacts the plan itself as well, right?
Absolutely.
I did want to ask as well, because you mentioned that they have a fair bit of cash and GICs outside of their stock holdings. How much were the GICs of their portfolio, and how important was the conversation around managing the maturities in retirement? Because you mentioned accumulation to decumulation, and I found that some people don't always appreciate when they're just rolling over GICs that, hey, they might need that money before it matures.
Yeah, so in their specific case, and I certainly understand where you're going. So in their specific case, they had money set aside for a short-term project. which was home renovations over the next 2 to 3 years. They were sticking them in 1 year GICs just to make a little bit of interest along the way. But really, their goal with that money was short term. So it kind of got pushed to the side when we're talking about the overall long term planning money. It's almost as if they'd already spent it. Now, what you're talking about with GICs is people don't realize that these are not necessarily liquid investments. And if you don't tell the bank, lots of times the bank just rolls them over for you, put you into another 1 year term. You really have to pay attention to what's going on with them. What's the available interest rate? Hey, yeah, they've been great in the past year or two, but interest rates are expected to fall this year. And so those rates on those GIC renewals are also gonna fall. So the availability of cash is number one. Certainly there are, if you wanted to look at short-term cash instruments, there are cash ETFs, funds, things like that. Maybe you won't get 5.25%, but maybe you'll get 4.75, but it'll be completely liquid and you can take it out any day of the week. So certainly, especially if it's in a taxable account and we're talking about an after-tax rate of return, the difference is almost negligible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's an important point, so I wanted to raise it, but I'm glad to hear that they had a specific purpose in mind with the GICs themselves, because, I mean, GICs can play a role in a portfolio, but there is a risk that sometimes isn't always appreciated until it's too late around retirement that you and I have seen before. So what are some of the key assumptions that you made when preparing the actual plan?
Yeah, so I'm not going to sort of reiterate some of the big ones that we talked about originally, but certainly delaying the CPP and OAS to 70. So then we started to think about drawing down RSPs in what they call the RSP meltdown. So if you have lower taxable income, you can take money out of your RSP at a low tax rate. Certainly that was important. Once they're over 65, it can be RIFs, so they can split income. Obviously the pension stuff they can split as well. In terms of portfolio returns, what we do is, in terms of the software, is, I'm not concerned if you own Royal Bank or Bank of Nova Scotia or what the specific stock is, but I'm concerned about how much you have in Canadian equities, how much you have in fixed income, because really we're trying to project returns, in this couple's case over, 40 years. That's an incredibly long time horizon. So to use asset classes rather than individual returns is where we focus in. And then, of course, we had to take a look at the fees, as you were talking about, those fees on those A-class funds. They really dig into the returns, the net returns that someone's going to receive. So they had an overall return profile of about 4.35% after fees. And then lastly, they're not making any TFSA contributions. They have a taxable investment account, a non-registered investment account, but not even sort of shifting money over from that account into a tax sheltered vehicle. And with the TFSA, unless you have a huge embedded capital gain, which was not the issue for them, it is almost a no-brainer to do that. Should you put money inside of an account on which you pay no tax, or an account that you do pay tax? To me, that's a pretty simple foregone conclusion to use the TFSA to its maximum potential.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I didn't realize that when reading the financial facelift, but that's a really important one, certainly. So their second primary goal for you was to determine what they should do around CPP and OAS. So what was your determination there?
Yeah, so the first sort of, quick back of the envelope calculation is, bet on how long you're going to live. So the first thing with CPP is the difference between age 60 and 65. So it's very punitive to take your CPP at 60. In fact, if we discount inflation, the break-even age becomes age 74. So if you're going to live past 74, you're better to wait to 65 rather than 60 to take CPP. The next break-even age is 81. And that's if you delay to 70 versus 65. Now, some people, by the time they're in their 60s, actually want the money, they're spending it. There's an argument, I'd rather have it when I'm healthy than maybe in my 80s when I'm less healthy, so on and so forth. But This is where you can get into the whole idea of, do you take money from the RSPs, lower the overall tax bill? There's lots of planning that you can do in and around that. OAS is very similar. Obviously, you cannot take OAS until you're 65. There's no 60 calculation. The break even, is certainly around the same point. It does vary a little bit depending on OAS, number of years you have it, and things like that. But there is an advantage to delaying to 70. For David and Greta, though, I didn't want to use rules of thumb. I didn't want to, try to make an educated guess. And this is where you get into, what you read in a newspaper versus your own personal financial plan. And I crunched the numbers for them in the plan, looking at it at 65 versus 70. And there was a clear financial benefit for them taking it at 70. So that's what I moved forward with.
Mm. And certainly, as we know, there's a the math is the math on one hand, and then you get the conversation around longevity, and it sounds like that wasn't an issue for them, but that can certainly play a role in the conversation as well. So if they continue as they have, will their retirement goals be achieved?
Well, the answer to that is yes and no. So yes, they will be achieved if the base case of assumptions that we make actually happens. So if they achieve their exact rate of return and, they withdraw exactly what they're going to withdraw and inflation sticks exactly where it is and so on and so forth, then yes, it will work. But we all know life doesn't move in a straight line. In fact, it moves much more in a messy, squiggly line, in my opinion. This gets back to the idea of sequence of returns. Volatility risk, especially in their portfolio with a large proportion of it being in stocks. And so I run a volatility analysis on the plan, and it shows me that their probability of success was 72%. So 7 out of 10 times they make it. Well, what if it's the other 3 out of 10? They're already downsizing their home in this. It's not like they have as much home as a cushion. So really I was looking at other factors. Well, retirement planning is, very arithmetic. So if you don't have enough to make it, well, what do? Well, you work longer, you save more, or you spend less. Those are the three factors that someone can control immediately. The fourth one is invest better. And that's often the preferable answer. Nobody wants to enjoy less retirement. Nobody wants to work longer. And by working longer is what's going to actually enable you to save more. But if you can just make some tweaks to your portfolio, we can actually change that 72% to 100% success. And for me, that is the best option to look at for David and Greta in terms of making their goals work. So my recommendation was to work with a portfolio manager with a focus on yield and income generation. Create a portfolio that has, 5.5% yield. Even after, portfolio manager costs, they're probably going to be 4.5%, 5%, somewhere around there in terms of their net returns. Then you only have to make maybe another 2% to get them up to 6. There's a lot of solid investment options out there that generate that type of income and tax efficient income as well. So we get them up to a simple 6% net of fees, and if you're making 4.5% in income, it's not a big jump to make 1.5-2% a year in growth. And then, of course, the other things would be make sure we are engaging in the deaccumulation strategies like melting down Greta's RRSP, about $40,000 a year, and then also the regular TFSA savings, and putting those all together really made it work for them.
And it's off topic a little bit, but maybe I could ask you for one example of tax efficient and income producing investment that you're referencing here.
Yeah, so one that I really like is, everyone knows dividend stocks. Hey, you put dividend stocks in your non-registered account and those are great. What's better than Canadian dividends for a high marginal tax rate person? Capital gains. And so using something like a covered call or put strategy, which generates income in the 10-11% range a year, and it's typically capital gains income, which is incredibly tax efficient. If you have a corporation, it's absolutely amazing because it also funds into the capital dividend account, which allows you to take income out of that corporation tax-free, that portion of it. So certainly, these are investments that maybe not the average person thinks about. And that's okay, because certainly this is where the expertise of a portfolio manager comes in.
That's great. And before we finish off, I wanted to ask if you had any additional comments on David and Greta's situation. Is this a common one that you come across, or if there's anything that you want to leave us with?
So every client situation is different, but there's certainly commonalities in them. People come in with poorly structured portfolios all the time, or let me rephrase that, poorly structured for the next stage of their life. They're fine for the accumulation, but decumulation is much different. There's other risks that you really need to consider that may make the portfolio that was constructed today not appropriate for what you're looking for the next stage of your life. And really, this speaks to the value of, having a retirement plan, in fact, a financial plan overall. Retirement is, almost a third of your life for most people. How are you going to make sure that your assets last and you minimize your taxes and that you have all the right things in place for your financial future? And so having a plan in place answers the questions that people have, and certainly that big one of, will I have enough? And the way I often think about the idea of a retirement plan and an investment portfolio is like your car. The investments are the gas in your car. You can blow the whole tank of gas driving around your block over and over again and get absolutely nowhere on your trip if you don't have a plan or a map to get you there. And that's where these two really come together. So because of all this, I feel it's really important to do a plan for every client who walks through the door. This way I can understand what are your real goals? What are the risks and opportunities for us working towards those goals? And let's look at the full picture of who you are and then create solutions that match those. Create a custom portfolio that meets the solution of that particular client's needs. So are there common factors? Absolutely. But at the same time, there are unique factors that we have to consider as well.
That's a great way to end it. Thanks again for joining me, Matt. That concludes this recording of Canadian Wealth Wisdom, and more specifically, our Financial Facelift series, a look at real planning questions Canadians are facing today.